You seem hungry. Good thing your table is ready with Fatterday Omaha.
Fatterday Omaha.
Eat this.
Oh, hey, this is Dave with Fatterday Omaha, and we are sitting in studio with an awesome guest who I will tell you about in just a second. Historically, you know, we've done a lot of restaurant reviews, overviews, and talk with chefs and restaurateurs and bartenders and folks, but it's kind of neat. We've been branching out a little bit more into recipes and connecting with food a little bit more, and I have somebody on the show today that grows food and provides it to others. I have Tim Fonfara on from the Omaha Urban Farmer, a brand new thing happening. So, Tim, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am doing very well. First of all, thank you for taking time out of your day and the many things that you need to do, growing things and getting your business plans and things like that for talking to me. So thanks for being here.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Very happy to be here.
First and foremost, and we'll get to this in a second, but there are some awesome containers sitting in front of me right now with some microgreens, some broccoli microgreens, and looks like purple radish, and we'll get to those in a second. But thank you for bringing those along, because I've never had a broccoli microgreen before.
Oh, absolutely.
I am new to the Omaha Urban Farmer, so if you would be so kind, kind of introduce, what is the Omaha Urban Farmer, and what do you do?
Well, it's actually very interesting because if you would ask me about 5-6 years ago if I would have been into farming, I would have looked at you like, what? The reason I got into this and my wife and I got into this is because I had a background a little bit in field theory, and there is an application for agriculture in field theory.
Okay.
And we actually had some land that was not being used that my grandparents left behind, and it used to be a farm way back in the day. And so I kind of said to my sweetheart, I was like, well, how would you like to turn this back into a farm? And she said, absolutely. And that was during the coronavirus times when everybody yeah. was locked down and whatnot. So we started beta testing, growing some food, and gave some samples out to try and figured out this was something we wanted to do. So, and that's where we are now.
Wow. So started during the pandemic. So while others were making sourdough bread, you're like, we're going to start a farm. Like, well, let's do this.
let's start this farm.
All right. So there was a phrase in there that I am not familiar with and would love to be, which is field theory. So tell me about that. I don't know what that is.
So to keep it real simple, if you enjoy using the electrical and the telecom grid that we use, that's thanks to field theory.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So like Maxwell's laws type field theory, or?
Yes. Actually, Maxwell, in reference to James Clerk Maxwell, he was actually a founding father of modern day field theory.
So magnetism in that type of field, not necessarily mm-hmm. a farming field.
Yeah, we've incorporated both now.
Aha. All right. So I naturally went for farming field there. So does that background apply to the plant farming, or was this a shift here? I see a head nod there. So
it's an aspect with electroculture, which falls in the category of field theory.
Yeah.
Which has been around a long time. And in fact, you know, you can actually Google information on field theory. But there's a lot of descriptions of it. They don't know exactly in terms of the explanation of how it works, okay. other than a handful of people that know what's going on. So with electroculture, which we apply to all our crops out in the field, helps as an aid for the root system.
Okay.
As an induction to increase the osmotic uptake for the root system. So you get more increase of the water and the nutrients and the minerals for the plant, and you get this phenomena of exponential growth rate within what would normally take weeks into maybe a few days.
Wow. So how does one impart an electric field on these growing plants?
There's simple methods to do it. I mean, I've seen some people and homesteaders do it that apply electroculture. They kind of do an overkill with too big of antennas in there. Uh-huh. But you really only need a copper or an aluminum antenna that's about a foot in height and for an area.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You said osmotic reaction. So there's different properties or whatever that are produced around the plants to enhance their growth. Is that kind of the idea there?
Yeah, it's actually much simpler than that. It's everything in nature is just follows the right-hand rule, which is go with the flow. So you have this natural go with the flow, and all that's happening, let's say, like when a thunderstorm comes through,
yeah,
and you got a saturated electrical field and it starts discharging.
Uh huh.
So that antenna is going to pick up the electrical field and it's going to help induce the osmotic uptake naturally just from being there.
So you had a background in that prior to starting the farm,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh, hey, we're going to put this knowledge to use from a farming aspect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How large is the Omaha Urban Farmer farm?
Well, the property itself is roughly about 7 acres,
okay,
and about 5 of it's farmable.
Uh-huh.
So this year, I think we'll utilize roughly around probably about 1 acre. But I still have a lot of foliage to clear out. So this year we'll put in more infrastructure, and the next year we'll put in more infrastructure until we basically hit capacitance on the area we have.
Starting this out around the heavy pandemic times, what did you decide to start out with growing? Like, what were your first crops?
Actually, it was the microgreens. Started out basically as a basement operation with doing that. And so we did some beta testing and we got pretty phenomenal results with microgreens. There's a few other microgreen farmers in the area too, but I haven't seen any of them apply any type of electroculture to their operation.
Uh-huh.
So as of right now, I have a tactical advantage in that regards. But it's really mind-blowing to see even what I know now, and I still see it happen, but we get germination rates at 98%+ in a matter of 2 to 4 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we have a couple of microgreens before us here, but do you remember which plants you made into microgreens to start with there?
I think we started, I know the broccoli was one, the radish was another one. There's a couple of varieties of radish. You have red radish, which is much more spicier. The purple is much milder. Let's see, pea shoots. And there's different varieties of pea shoots now. And then I got really good with procuring cilantro.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Cilantro is a tougher grow. It's typically a medium pace grower. I think most microgreen farmers take roughly around 3 weeks to get a crop out of a tray. I got it down to about 2 weeks.
So you have about 1 acre of external farmable land, and sounds like you also have growing indoors, so you can do things year round as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so me learning in the last few minutes here about electroculture sounds like here. So how does that get applied inside where you don't have a copper rod and a thunderstorm outside?
So there is a method using a powerful magnet to induce, change the rate, basically attune the water molecule is what it boils down to. And that's really the least looked at aspect of electroculture. Most people know about the antenna array out there, but there's a proper way to treat water and treat seeds with using a magnet.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So definitely learning a lot here. And of course, you know, our, you know, induction burners and things like that, you're using a you know, spinning magnet or whatever to induce electron movement within a pan to heat it up to cook. And there's different aspects here for plant growing. That's wild. So you're able to apply those concepts both outdoors and indoors year round.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So with the microgreens and things like that, did you start providing those to restaurants or like farmers markets, or how did the, not just you trying them yourself, but the growing the business and things like that, what connections did you make to get your greens out there?
Really, it was just the old fashioned way. We got plugged into marketing groups and started meeting people. I got connected with a restaurant and gave them some samples. They were really happy with them. And then I helped them out with, because they also have their own grow operation. So there's some things that they just don't have the time or the capacity to do. So they'll send it my way and basically contract it out for them to do that. So and then still to this day, I mean, I'm meeting people more and more to find out where my next basically business contract is going to shape up to be.
Are there any restaurants that folks might know out there that you provide greens to?
Oh, yeah. If you've been to Gather in Omaha downtown.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have their own in-house grow operation. And so they really liked my cilantro. So I do cilantro for them on the regular, plus some other micros, depending on, you know, what the chefs want to do for their menu.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, and actually, I unfortunately have not been to Gather yet, so there's a place I need to go. I've seen pictures of the inside of the growing mm-hmm. operation. It looks very cool because it's kind of part yeah. of the restaurant, which is super.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the, you know, farm to table or farm to fork, you know, movement and that kind of thing, you're able to provide, you know, greens very close to the restaurant. I mean, you're in, you know, driving distance. You
oh, yeah.
here to see me today. So, you know, we have a great restaurant community. So that's very cool. So people know where their food is coming from and things like that. Now, do you cook at home as well or you know, or lots of taste testing of your greens?
Well, my wife's going to be listening to this, so I'll give her the credit that awesome. She does the cooking at home. I do the growing and the procuring of the greens and whatnot. But she does also help with a lot of the herbs that we do, too. Uh-huh. She mostly handles that portion. But yeah, I mean, it's quite the smorgasbord of different things we try to produce. And the whole idea behind our farm model is to be a regenerative model and a model based on redundancy. Hmm. A lot of the old farms or the farms that have been established around, most people think, you know, monocropping. Mm-hmm. So their money is all in one crop.
Right,
but
we're just growing corn and
yeah. things like that. But the new or the next generation of farmers that's kind of picking up the torch is what they're doing is they're getting smaller plots of land.
Okay.
And they're working 1 to 3 acres and just putting the infrastructure in there and start producing. And once they're established and selling their stuff locally, they're doing $100,000 to $300,000 a year in revenue for just growing food and selling it locally.
Just off an acre or so of land.
1 to 3 acres.
From the regenerative aspect then, so letting, you know, on those larger farms, either rotating your crops, like maybe you do something like corn and then switch to soybeans or something, or let your farm go, I think fallow is the right word, you know, letting it sit there. So how do you make sure that your crops are regenerative, or what's that process there of making sure you can keep going?
Sure. Well, there's not really a set definition to the term regenerative, other than it's getting at the input-output management of the soil.
Okay.
Hopefully or ideally in a natural or organic method.
Yeah.
Whether if you're using like chicken manure or things like the compost, you could be using, your wood shavings and mulch and stuff like that for cover crops and things like that. But really it's just our approach is a no-till approach. Obviously, when you have to go break ground, you have to break up the sod.
Sure.
So I do everything by hand. I don't use a rototiller.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've been doing everything by hand. The idea behind that is you're less aggressive when you break up the soil biome, so it doesn't have to try to rebuild itself. If you leave your soil exposed and you start to see the weeds coming up, mm-hmm. that's actually just the soil biome trying to protect itself.
Mm.
Because if it doesn't have any feed or input, it's going to start eating itself, and that's what breaks down your biome now. And that's kind of the downside to monocropping, which we've been doing since post-World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we face the dilemma of going and replenishing the land and using a natural method to do so. And mm-hmm. So far, the best way I've seen to do that is a regenerative approach to fixing the land and letting nature do what nature wants to do.
Because in a larger operation, you often need like to add, you know, like what, ammonia or nitrogen or external means to replenish, because the plants are that you're harvesting are pulling up all those nutrients.
Yeah,
right?
There's a lot of synthetics, and that's kind of been a big aspect of the farming business, and there's traditionally been a lot of money in that input cost. But if that was to change over and eliminate that with, I mean, you're talking about changing the whole paradigm of how we farm. Mm-hmm. And truth be told, we're getting to that point. I mean, we can't keep doing the monocropping techniques like we used to, because the land's exhausted and the old business model is becoming obsolete now. So now we have to go with methods that are going to be much more in tune with nature.
How about things like pest control and things like that? How is that accomplished in, with the same model?
If you're going with a more regenerative approach, nature likes it. Redundancy. So you want to biodiversify your farm operation as much as possible. So you got like ladybugs that will eat the aphids and things like that. You have certain sparrows and birds that will eat other insects or pests, things like that. So that's what nature likes to do. Human beings like to, you know, chemically spray and then they end up, you know, getting contaminating their own food in the process. But I think we've finally come to our senses on that largely, and now are starting to change things. So
around your outdoor farm, do you ever plant anything that attracts those natural pest control methods like ladybugs or birds or anything like that? Or is it just the crops that you grow naturally invite that because you aren't setting up any chemical barriers anything like that?
Well, the nice thing about our particular, it's been sitting dormant for several decades now. So it's already had a nice biome and biodiversified environment there. So we have plenty of ladybugs and birds, owls and hawks that come through. And snakes are also a natural pest control. We have those too in the area. So I luckily don't have to worry about that so much. But that's not to say the next farmer might have to go and rebuild their, you know, biome and biodiversify their farm again. So yeah, we lucked out in that department.
So the land has been sitting dormant. You said it's your grandmother's land?
Yeah, my grandparents had it, acquired it in the 70s. And then prior to them, it was an old farm couple that had it. And so probably the last time it was actually farmed was probably in the 60s or 70s.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. So pretty fertile land at this point.
And it's immaculate soil. Like you stick your hand, it's like cake batter. There's, you know, lots of worms and insects in it. So yeah, it's just ready to go. So
for the indoor perspective then, as far as replenishing that soil, do you use soil from the exterior farm or no soil? Is it a hydroponic you know, how does work inside?
So my method, I like to use coco-coir.
Oh, okay.
So I order in. It's pretty inexpensive and you get quite a bit out of a block of it. So I use mine once, and then I'll use it to throw it out in the field once the mats are done. So you can compost it naturally, and that's a big method too, is we're playing around with different compost methods for the outdoors. It's really simple and straightforward. Depending on which, you know, micro crop I'm trying to do, it could be, you know, a week or so turnaround. Like the ones I brought, these are 9 days old.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And they're beautiful, by the way. They look awesome. It's unfortunately in the audio medium, you'll have to check our social for pictures. But yes, I have some very deep green broccoli shoots with some nice little stems here. And those purple radishes have a great color on them too. So they look very healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
The material you had mentioned there, what is that made out of?
Coco coir?
Yes. Yes.
It's basically the byproduct of... actually, I'm not even exactly sure when they use coconuts. And it's kind of a byproduct that they can use to go and use as a growing medium. So they package it and they dehydrate it and they'll put them in either in discs or big blocks, and then they sell them through the suppliers. And then when you're ready to use it, you just put it in and then you add about 5 to 6 gallons of water on my blocks that I use. And then you get about 15 gallons worth of coco coir growing medium. Yeah.
And then for inside, do you have to continuously water or periodically, because the coco coir holds on to a lot of moisture? Or how do you keep the plants happy and healthy throughout their growing cycle?
You know, that particular growing medium is like a Ferrari in terms of growing medium, because it is the most mold resistant and it's the highest retention rate for moisture. So typically, depending on your air circulation, but I only have to water maybe once or twice a day on most of my trays to do that. If I turn the air circulation up, then I'll probably have to do a little bit more just because it'll dry out faster.
It dries out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Moisture wicking away there in that case. And do you have a computerized watering system, or do you just, hey, I'm just going to water my plants? Or
I do everything by hand with love, so.
So when it comes time to harvest, like the greens that we have in front of us here, how do you harvest in the field versus how do you harvest from the inside?
Oh, the inside is pretty simple. I mean, it's almost like a no-brainer in terms of simplicity. But no, I just take the trays off and then I'll use some harvesting scissors and just cut them and put them in the packages like you see in front of you like that. And then it's just, 10 minutes of harvesting and that's it for the indoor operation. The outdoor obviously takes a little bit more work.
Sure.
You're exposed to the elements and get to deal with any type of heat and all that stuff. But it just really just depends on the crop itself outside. So
a lot of the microgreens grown indoors. And then what type of other things are you growing outdoors?
So this year we're doing a lot of different things. I'm going to be doing a couple of varieties of watermelon. We're going to do lettuce. Tomatoes, we'll do a Kielderkraut cabbage. Wow. So I try to do more rare heirlooms. Mm-hmm. It just as a farmer, the way it kind of works as a business aspect, I don't like to step on other farmers' toes when we go to the market.
Like, oh, sure.
Because you might have like one or two tomato farmers there, and if you're going to sell a tomato, don't sell the same that they're selling. So
I like that.
We like to be a coopetition is what we like.
So if I go to the Omaha Urban Farmer, I might see a purple heirloom tomato that looks one way. And then I go to another one and I see a red striped one from another farmer.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah.
That's very, very cool. So your seeds that you get, do you find just a seed provider and you say, I want to order XYZ tomato? Or what's your process of obtaining those first seeds? And bonus question, are you then able to use any of that first crop to start the next one? Or do you typically have to get more seeds? How does that work?
There's several seed suppliers out there. It was just a matter of going out and doing the homework on heirlooms. I like to use Baker Creek. Shout out to them. RareSeeds.com is their site, but they specialize in kind of rare and ultra rare heirlooms. And then there's other ones too, like Gurney's and let's see what else. True Leaf Market is the one I use for the micros and lettuce. Lettuce is actually another one we're looking into. I haven't quite mentioned it, but a common answer that comes back from a lot of the chefs and the restaurants that I talk to is that they have trouble getting really good quality lettuce. And this is an interesting fact I've come across in the venture that the farming that I've come is that as an agricultural state, we import 90% of our produce.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So if we were to flip that around, we are definitely not getting an A plus on keeping our produce. Wow. 90%.
Yes.
So you're aiming to change that percentage a little bit.
we're hoping to change, or at least start the change. I'm sure this will kind of catch on. There's no reason why we should be importing produce when we're an agricultural powerhouse of a state. And a lot of things, the simple things like lettuce, the restaurants have to get, and they kind of say all the same thing. It's at least 2 weeks old by the time they get it, and it's mediocre quality. So there's no better option than getting Farmer Direct. That's as good as it gets. And even the big corporations understand this, and they are starting to run to this business model. They're not walking, they're running.
Well, especially as a chef wanting to use the best thing available, the freshest thing available, because you can certainly taste it.
Sure.
You can see it. We're talking about vegetables that taste like something that weren't gassed tomatoes or whatever to ripen them, et cetera. And there's a difference. And I think a lot of the Omaha listening area, and if you're listening to this on the podcast, please stop by Omaha and try some local produce here. Tasting an heirloom tomato versus a typical grocery store tomato, there's a difference there.
Oh, yes.
Quite a big difference. From your perspective, or maybe for those that aren't familiar with, what is an heirloom vegetable or an heirloom seed? What does that mean?
When you hear the term heirloom, that means that it's not commercialized typically. So if you hear of an heirloom tomato, that means that it's produced out there. You can buy the seed for it, but there isn't really a corporation or a business that's really producing it in mass. So that's really, it's just a commercialization term.
And definitely having seen a few heirloom tomatoes too, quite often you get some beautiful shapes and colors and one looks a little different than another. Yeah. And there's some beauty in the difference of each of those vegetables.
Definitely. So
from a lettuce perspective, so it sounds like Nebraska is importing a lot of its lettuce. And so you're looking to shift that a little bit too. I guess I don't know how a typical lettuce starts. Is it a seed? Is it a bulb? How does it form?
There's different varieties of lettuce, but the most common is your iceberg lettuce. But that even can be done loose leaf. And this is kind of a tip to everybody who's listening out there too. Even if you have to go to the store and you buy the lettuce that's there, take it out of the plastic and wrap it in aluminum foil. That will revitalize your head of lettuce. Typically, you know, you're getting a head of lettuce that's probably about 2 weeks old at that point. So it's already starting to deteriorate a little bit, but you can revitalize that by just take it out of the plastic so it's not suffocating anymore. And then you can put it in aluminum. But, to answer your question, like if you've ever looked at lettuce seeds, I mean, they're tiny. I mean, like visualization, maybe a quarter of an inch in length, if that.
Gotcha. Like a pencil eraser type.
Yeah, basically like the end of your pencil.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing to see. They start out real small, and then you plant them, and then the proper way to do that with is usually plant a few in a point, and then you basically cull the sprouts, take the weakest ones out, and then you got the strongest one and let that go to maturity. So
that's how you get it started, and then do lettuces typically flower and go to seed and you can save the seeds, or do you just typically have to get more seeds to continue that going?
I mean, you can perpetuate your own seed if you want to. You got to go to let it go to bolt, and they typically do that if it gets hot enough. Depending on the strain. But there's a lot of new strains of lettuce where they tried to get it more heat tolerant. Mm-hmm. And especially since Nebraska can be hit and miss on weather. Last couple of years we've had sprummers where it just kind of just rolled right into heat. So it was a lot more difficult to do lettuce outside. But I mean, you can run high tunnels and stuff and put shade cloth on that to mitigate that.
I'm assuming a tomato kind of the same way. Can you dry the seeds out from any leftover tomatoes and perpetuate that?
Yeah, you can actually do a seed crop. We actually did that last year for our black strawberry tomato. It's a very plum-like, berry-like tomato.
Yeah.
It's an heirloom that I got from Baker Creek. It's trying to describe, over the radio what that flavor is like. But
sure.
People that were on the fence with tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
That were like neither here nor there, or maybe didn't like them.
Uh-huh.
I gave them this tomato.
Uh-huh.
They loved it.
Is this one of those that will make you truly believe that a tomato is a fruit instead of a vegetable?
I think so, yeah.
How many types of lettuces are you growing right now?
For this year, I think we'll do probably focus on two. Our classic iceberg, and then there's a butter crunch.
Ooh,
yeah. We start to get into the butter leaf lettuces. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. That's another thing where you get it into more, I would say exotic, but premium grade type lettuce. And a lot of chefs like that, too. And if they want to present something different other than just, iceberg.
Yeah. I do like a good butter lettuce. And I can safely say that I don't believe I've ever had a fresh farm grown iceberg lettuce. Longtime listeners of this show will know that I give iceberg lettuce a hard time a lot, because often if you head to some restaurants, it's like, oh yeah, here's your side salad. Here's this, the iceberg lettuce is a carrier for dressing, and that's about it. It doesn't taste like much else. So having not had a locally grown iceberg lettuce, what does it taste like? Is it just a more earthy taste? Does it have some taste?
Oh yeah. I actually gave, this was probably a couple summers ago when we were kind of testing out doing lettuce. I have a friend that runs a taco stand, and I said, here, come try this. Let me, give it out to your, put it into your tacos. And he actually had some people come back and tell him that was the best lettuce that they ever had. So yeah, they were pretty excited about that. And they were asking them, are you going to get more?
Wow. Wow. That is saying something if the lettuce is good enough that somebody wants to come and remark on it on a taco, because there's lots of powerful flavors there, and to go, hey, the lettuce was good? That's awesome.
Yeah, it's not just the flavor of it, it's the texture of it.
Oh, how does it differ?
I would describe it closely as best I can is like velvet on your tongue.
Wow. So more towards, I guess, a butter lettuce is something I typically think of as being very soft, and iceberg, not so much. So two different types of lettuces. You got the microgreens. Mm-hmm. We've got some tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Anything else springing up there as we're talking now as the spring has sprung?
Let's see here. We also have a few apple trees and apricots that are coming out. It'll probably be a couple of seasons before they're producing fully.
Oh, sure.
But we did plant that aspect. So we've really diversified that. We've done a Jarrahdale pumpkin last year. We did a seed crop for it. It took me a while to get to secure the seed for it because it was so popular on with the supplier that I think I got some the year before, but that was that summer of inferno when we had triple digits.
Oh, like for a week or whatever it was.
Yeah, almost like a month. And I tried planting it, and it just killed the crop. But last year we got some and we had really good results with it. If you've never seen a Jarrahdale, it's a New Zealand heirloom, and it's got a bluish gray skin to it.
Oh, cool.
And it's an eating pumpkin. I've always loved pumpkin pie growing up.
Sure.
And one of my favorite things, I did not have pumpkin pie until I had a Jarrahdale pumpkin pie.
Game changer, huh?
Game changer. I gave this to a few people that I knew that were into heirlooms and stuff that I was growing. I gave it to a colleague in one of my marketing groups. And I said, here, try this and let me know what you think.
Uh-huh.
And so she went and took it, and she prepped it and cut it up. She said, it was so good, I went back into the trash can and pulled the seeds from the trash can to save the seed.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how good it was.
I have not had one. That is very, very cool.
Yeah.
The inside operation, and definitely focused on the microgreens, are there any larger produce that get grown inside as well, or is it mostly focused on the microgreens?
So far, the focus is the microgreens. I am kind of beta testing, doing some indoor grow towers to possibly do some, you know, lettuce during the off season. Obviously, it won't be as big of a crop, but if we have success with it, we'll certainly implement it on a indoor grow tower, a soil-based one. So
the inside space, so the outside, you're farming about an acre or so currently?
Yeah, this season will be about an acre or so. Maybe we might even get it up to about an acre and a half, just depending.
Gotcha. And how big is the indoor side of things? Because you probably don't have an acre of land or space inside a building.
I actually converted the original house over on the property to an indoor grow. So yeah. So we're using just the main level on it. So we have about 10 racks in there, and as we grow that, we'll do some more. But it's probably about 1,800 to 2,000 square feet, just normal size house, you know.
So you're taking the phrase farmhouse to a whole new level.
Yeah. It actually, we call it the farmhouse.
Farmhouse. So let's see. So you started in 2020, give or take a little bit.
Yeah,
so
2021, around that time frame.
And so things have literally been growing and connecting with our local restaurants and things like that. So now that these awesome greens have been sitting here, let's pop one open. I'm going to pop open the broccoli here. I don't know that I've ever had a broccoli micro. I've had pea shoots for microgreens, and we were talking a little bit about pea shoots at the beginning here. So we're going to open this up, and I'm going to do my best not to flip this on the floor. There is a historical episode of this show where Stacy Like from Buttered Marshmallow brought in a cake. And I opened it up in a very poor fashion, and it exploded all over my face. So I'm going to try to not do that with the microgreens. All right. So before me, I have what looks like a combination of sprouts and four-leaf clovers. They are very beautiful, and we're gonna grab some here and try them. And let's give them a bite. Here we go. Oh, wow. There's a ton of flavor in there.
Yes.
Almost a kind of a buttery, nutty note almost to them. That's wild. I took a bite of just two of them. That's a flavor powerhouse for something so small.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm going to talk with my mouth full on the radio, but it's official because it actually is for the show. You had mentioned that, you know, if you like broccoli and cheese, maybe you had some uses for these guys. So like a quesadilla?
Oh, yeah. If you find yourself being a broccoli and cheese fan, that is excellent with, homemade quesadillas. You could probably use some other ones with lettuce wrap sandwiches. We've done that with.
Mm-hmm.
The possibilities are quite endless, but those are just a handful of things that we've done with our own recipes, just using it. I mean, you can cook it with soups and any types of soups that have cheese in it. That's excellent.
And no lie here. Honestly, you could just eat this whole thing straight. Like, I would not trouble this with a heavy dressing at all if one was to use these, just because I think you'd mask the flavor. They're delicious. That's awesome. Yeah. So the other one you brought is a purple radish microgreen.
Yeah, this is a purple radish. So if you've ever had a red radish, they're pretty spicy. This is much more toned down in terms of the spiciness to it. But they're quite popular to use just in adding a different color scheme to your food there. Yeah, I'll let it speak for itself.
Yeah, and I'll take a bite here in a second. The coloring, though, is awesome because if we're looking at the broccoli, definitely green notes, dark green, light green. On the purple radish here, the top does have a deep purple hue where the underside of the leaf still has a little bit of green. But the stems also kind of have a little bit of purple to them, which is awesome. And between the two, very stark difference in color there. So let's try a purple radish. We're going to grab, I'm going to do the same thing we did with the broccoli and try two of them and try not to choke on the microgreens on the microphone here. That is a very different flavor. Not as nutty as the broccoli. There is a little bit of that radish spice to it. Just a tingle on the side of the tongue there, I think, where they're sitting, but it's not overpowering either, but you could convince a person that you were adding a little spice or a little capsaicin element there, even though that maybe there isn't one. Those are very good as well. Those are awesome. And two totally different flavors between each. Those are wild.
Yeah.
And how fun that something so small can pack such a flavor punch.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
You had mentioned off mic, you're kind of making some innovations or some connections that allow you to get your produce, your greens, your hard work into the hands of chefs and others. But how does it make it from farm to table? How does it get there?
Well, the best way, thanks to technology, we've actually partnered with Barn to Door.
Okay.
They built our web store. And we just got it live going probably about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, brand new. Wow.
But if you want to check out our web store, on our website is omahaurbanfarmer.com.
Okay.
And currently we have our microgreens listed. As we get closer to the season for our spring crops and stuff, we'll post the availability for any of the crops there on the site. And it's really a great way for consumers to connect without either of us having to do a whole lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. They can go on, they can put in their order, they can schedule a delivery day. I can deliver directly to them.
Oh, cool.
Or they can actually, if they want to choose on Saturday to come down and pick up anything that they'd like, they certainly have the option to do so.
Oh, so you could literally come right to the farm and get them fresh off the farm.
Yeah.
Where is the farm?
Farm is in South Omaha. We're kind of tucked away in the neighborhood there off 48th and Harrison. Mm-hmm. If you're aware where they built a new school, Blue Stem, mm-hmm. we're literally neighbors to them right there.
As a young kiddo off of 48th and Harrison, there was a family over there, the Knoblocks, and they raised chickens. And we used to go get farm fresh eggs over there.
Yeah.
And that whole area between, 48th and Y Street to around 48th and Harrison, there's actually a surprising amount of like land kind of tucked in neighborhoods mm-hmm. there, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting because most people don't know the old city line was Y Street. And then the city had annexed, the city of Omaha, annexed all the way down to Harrison Street. So you have these like little plots of land and farmsteads that got grandfathered in when they annexed there. So, yeah, you see, you know, a lot of little plots of land that are just kind of tucked away there.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to, I lived in that general vicinity for a while. You would have people raising chickens or you'd see goats or things because of the way that the system was kind of grandfathered in so that you could still farm essentially there a little bit different, right in the middle of the city, essentially.
Oh, yes. Still going on. So.
So these microgreens that you brought to me in these containers here, if I were to take these home, how do I make sure that they stay at their best and freshest when I'm ready to use them?
So you can refrigerate those. Most microgreens you can refrigerate, and the nice thing about, you know, Farmer Direct, you're getting as fresh as possible, and those are will stay that quality for at least 2 weeks before it really starts to slowly deteriorate. It'll last you at least 3 to 4 weeks total if you wanted to ride it out until expiration or not. But really that first 2 weeks is where it's at.
Gotcha. So you don't need to spritz them with water or anything like that. Just leave them.
You can give them a little bit of water. I mean, treat it like any other vegetable, mm-hmm. you know, wash your vegetables and things like that. But yeah, water will freshen up if you happen to have really, really dry air in your house. So.
Oh yeah. And you know, depending on the season, of course, you might have the furnace on or something like that. Sure. And yeah.
And there's a few oddballs with certain plants and microgreens. I've done micro basil before. Hmm. Basil does not like refrigerated temps.
Whatsoever. Oh yeah.
You have to keep it ambient.
Gotcha.
So it's best to use basil sooner than later.
Gotcha. So if you're going to make that pesto, do it right away.
Yeah, do it right away.
Throw it on that margarita pizza. So when you're setting up links with restaurants, how do you go about making sure that you can continue to provide there? Do you say, okay, I have this much land and I get this much yield? And well, I'll let you tell the story. If a restaurant says, hey, I would love some purple radish microgreens, but I need X amount every day for whatever, how does that work? So you make sure you can provide for them.
Sure, it's just a lot of pre-planning and whatnot ahead of time, especially if you're looking to get, you know, crop outdoors. It's best to go before the season kicks in, talk to the farmer, or in this case, talk to myself, to figure out what either a restaurant or a chef is looking for. Sometimes they might want to say, I'll buy this whole market row out and use it for the season, and I would be happy to do that, or whatever the farmer is willing to do. So it really just depends on the demand, mm-hmm. and then just figuring out scaling it to production. That's really what it boils down to.
Gotcha. And then at a certain point, I'm assuming, you know that your area of land or your indoor space is used up, and that's probably all you can do at a certain point.
If we hit capacitance, then at that point, you either say, no, I can't do it, or we go get more land.
Gotcha. Yeah, fair enough. How many local restaurants are you providing for? We had mentioned Gather. You have a partnership there.
Yeah, currently one, but I'm in the works with talking with some others. I've given some samples out. So it's really some stuff. It just depends if it's on their menu or not. Not sure. A whole lot of people know about microgreens yet. In fact, here in the Midwest, 9 out of 10 people still don't know what microgreens are. So it's starting to become a new thing here. It's really big on the coasts, mm-hmm. but more and more, I notice restaurants are starting to incorporate microgreens into their menu.
We've been talking microgreens since probably the start of that, but what if nobody's ever heard of a microgreen? How would you describe a microgreen?
You know, I tell people, they'll ask, what is a microgreen? And I said, well, if you've had an alfalfa sprout in your life, then you've had a microgreen. Okay. So, but yeah, it's just the early stage of germination with most plants that they use. And I know I was talking a little bit about field theory earlier, but yeah. there's a saying in field theory, the higher the capacitance of something or of a field, the smaller the spatial displacement. So you're actually getting more in a smaller space than you are getting in a diluted space from it being so much. That's why it's typically 20 to 40 times higher nutritional content versus you know, a full grown fruit or plant.
Because it's nutrient dense then. Mm-hmm. So is it like less water, or is it just that the nutrient is spread out over the larger plant versus being compact in this single shoot?
Sure. The easiest way I teach people, because being a farmer and doing what I do, and a lot of this is a big portion of it is actually education.
Yeah.
If you want to think of seeds as nature's zip files, okay, so when you start watering, it starts to germinate. That file is starting to unzip. Mm-hmm. So nature has this way of, in terms of compression and putting everything in. So when you get close to the seed stage of any type of plant, it's going to have higher capacitance of nutrients and everything. So whether, you know, just going in or just coming off the germination stage, you have a really high density of nutrients there.
Interesting. Almost like a potential energy, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of it's kind of packed in there. It's coming from potential is where it's coming from.
Wow. Up until several minutes ago, I didn't know that broccoli microgreens were a thing. I have had other microgreens, and you know, we talked about pea shoots and things like that. Besides broccoli, any other unexpected microgreens that you're growing, or what other types of greens are out there that are like, oh, hey, I didn't know that those existed?
Sure. The cilantro microgreens are a big one, as I mentioned doing it earlier, but
yeah.
I'll have to show you a picture of what a crop looks like, a full tray. But it's just the baby leaf stage of, and the taste is 100% the same as a true leaf of a cilantro. But yeah, that's another one. Pea shoots. On occasion, we do amaranth, which is red amaranth, kind of is comparable to cabbage in terms of flavor.
Okay.
And then we have some other ones too, like kale.
Yeah.
Kale is actually very similar to the broccoli in terms of
appearance. Interesting. Yeah. I'm assuming that the leaves are a little bit softer than a full grown kale, or do they still kind of have that kind of thicker heartiness?
About like what you taste with the broccoli.
With the broccoli.
Yeah. It was like that. Yeah.
I love the fact that you are growing diverse crops that, I mean, you're literally putting your back into it every day, whether that's harvesting by hand with scissors or tilling the land minimally to prepare the soil for growth and handling all these things. And it seems like the growth of your farming efforts, you got to have a lot of heart in this. And it sounds like it brings a smile to your face.
It does.
To do this.
I absolutely love this. Me and my wife really do enjoy growing things. And I will tell you this, if you know you're from a traditional growing background or a traditional farmer, and if you thought you loved farming, then you haven't discovered the love of farming until you've done electroculture. It will blow your mind.
I have learned so much. I have several things to probably Google outside of this to learn even more. I have these beautiful greens in front of me here, which are fantastic. And thank you for bringing in the fruits or leaves of your labor here for me to try. And there are two things that I've never had before until today. And I really appreciate you spending time with me and teaching and bringing this to me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me here today. Thank you so much.
That's awesome. And I know we had mentioned the website, but just in case people want to learn more about the Omaha Urban Farmer, where's the best place to follow along, to see what's going on, to find out where they can, you know, maybe meet you or at a farmer's market or something like that?
Sure. We're trying to get into a couple of the farmer's market. We're confirmed into the Gifford Park Friday evening.
Oh, cool.
And then we're pending application with Papillion.
Okay.
And the Florence Farmers Market.
Okay.
And then we do have a Facebook page, the Omaha Urban Farmer LLC. So you can find us there too.
That's perfect. And you know, the Gifford Farmers Market, I'm glad you brought that up. So that's around California Taco and Myrtle and Cypress, I think are up there, right? So about 30th and California.
Yeah, sounds about right.
That's kind of a neat spot. I you know, the Omaha Downtown Farmers Market and the one at Exarban certainly get a lot of local attention. But that Gifford Park one's pretty cool. And if you drive by, it's like, oh, wow, what's going on here? It's pretty neat.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. We actually have not done that one yet. Uh-huh. So this will be brand new vendors to that to that market this year. So
very cool. And where's the Papillion one located? Because I don't think I've been there.
The Papillion Farmers Market is right in downtown in the park there.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of the name of the park.
Yeah. Yep.
But
yep.
Yeah, it's right there.
Is it Halleck Park, maybe? One of those. Anyway, yeah. Downtown Papillion. So gotcha. So if you're stopping by, Sauce Bio, Faro, and Grayley's are both down there. So
yeah.
You've got some good options
right by
if,
there.
You're,
yeah.
if you're hanging out there. So very cool. Well, thank you again, Tim Favera, for spending time with me, with the listeners. And as we say on the show, until we eat again. Stay hungry and try some microgreens. We'll see you later. Bye.
Our show is recorded and produced by Fatterday Omaha. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, as well as email fatterdayomaha@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay hungry.
Fatterday Omaha.
Eat this.